Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode of Digital Artcast. Thanks again for tuning in and checking out the episode that we've got today. In a tradition of what we've been doing the last couple of weeks, trying to break up what we previously had on, which is against things like concept artists, 3D artists. We had some UI guys on recently, and people from different walks of industry. But again, yeah, so what we're trying to do this week is talk more about the industry as a whole and where it sits and what's going on with it. Because, you know, unless you've been living under a rock for the last couple of weeks, you would have noticed that both tech and games, and maybe even to an extent films, have been going through a kind of recession in the sense that, you know, there's been less work, there's been less jobs, there's been mass layoffs. Our last episode with Fernando Ferrero, we talked about that when he worked at Blizzard and him having to say goodbye to a lot of his colleagues all of a sudden when Blizzard faced a major layoff. I think Blizzard Activision was 1,900 people. I can't remember the specific numbers from where that came from, just Blizzard, but yeah, it was a good couple hundred people anyway, including the fact that they cancelled the survival game. So that whole squad of people who were working that for the last past 2-3 years were laid off or moved on. So in that regard, I have been speaking to a recruiter, someone I've actually had on my LinkedIn for a couple of years now. We've had a back and forth conversation about the industry and the way it has been for a while. And I just eventually thought it'd be a good idea to get him on to talk about, from his perspective as a recruiter, where the industry is at currently, and maybe anything we can do to kind of navigate the minefield that is games and tech at the moment, and how to maybe keep either in a job or look for new jobs and get back off the rebound of being laid off. So today, I want to introduce someone that I think will be a great interviewee, Mr. Darren Butler. Hey, Darren, how's it going?
Hey, Gordy, how are you doing? And thanks for inviting me on. It's been, as you say, it's been a couple of years since we've been kind of connected and talking to each other. We've shared lots of different insights. So it's nice to kind of formalize this and potentially get it out to kind of the masses in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's also hard with LinkedIn and other social sites where you always put a thing where you have a face and a name, but you don't always get a kind of one-to-one conversation with people. And it's something I think we're definitely losing in the digital age of like having wholehearted conversations and trying to sit down and talk to people face to face. It's definitely a lost art these days. So
Sure. I think that's probably like the biggest thing that I've noticed since 2020 is that so much of my job now is done online via video meetings and things like that. And I'm almost kind of, it's always a bit of a nice surprise when something drops into the calendar and it's like, oh, I'm going to go meet someone at a coffee shop and it's going to be like a face-to-face meeting, or I'm going to this event and I've got a face-to-face meeting event like set up. So it's real. It's nice to be able to do these kind of one-on-one conversations in this manner.
Break up the monotony of emails and schedule stuff and try and get a bit of human interaction. Right. So
exactly.
As of recording today, I think, is it tomorrow you're going down to an event in Manchester?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So I'll be on the road from tomorrow afternoon. I'm landing in Manchester at sort of 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. And then there's an event Thursday evening, Reformat, which is a industry social kind of party, but there's like keynote speakers there and stuff like that. So it's just a really like brilliant opportunity to get some face time with people that, again, like yourself, like I've had lots of like online conversations back and forward, emails, messages, that sort of thing for the last year and a half, 2 years, and it'd be nice to just kind of see them face to face for the first time.
I do enjoy the old school idea of just having a conversation with someone, which I think is, again, like you say, through socials lost, and the days of talking to people seems like it's fading out, but I don't want it to, because that's part of the reason I enjoy these podcasts, because I get to talk to people face to face and engage with them. So I'm really glad that you're here and that we get to have this conversation. So
appreciate it.
You are a gaming and recruiter, official title. You're running your own business, your own kind of like recruitment agency, which specializes just in games or everything else, or like just games?
Yeah, so it is just games. That is something that I've been passionate about for a number of years. It's where my kind of experience, or a vast majority of my experience, is. So just to kind of give people a little bit of background about myself,
please.
I've 7 years experience in recruitment. I started out in software development recruitment in 2011. Very much at the beginning of like the app store boom, so everyone was looking for iOS and Android developers to come in and, you know, make an iPhone or an Android app for them. And it very quickly kind of mutated into, okay, well, what other uses are there for C# and C++? And, you know, it was kind of like the advent of tools like Unity and Unreal being kind of open source and on the market. And there were loads of studios that were kind of struggling with like their recruitment needs at that period of time, because very similar to kind of the process, or like, you know, cyclical nature of the games industry as it is, 2011 we were coming off the back of, you know, mass layoffs, you know, huge studio closures, breakups, acquisitions, that sort of thing. So
sounds very familiar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very similar to kind of what's happened over the last sort of 18 months, 2 years.
Yeah.
For us here. And it was you know, it was a good time to get into games recruitment at that period.
Mm-hmm.
I then stepped away from recruitment for a period of years. There's a number of different reasons for that, but ultimately I went into kind of more salesy business development type roles for a few years that kind of fit around my family structure and what I was doing like in my personal life at that time, and then came back to recruitment post COVID in 2020. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing that ever since. And yeah, as you said, started my own business back in October last year, capitalizing on that network and that experience, and just being able to do it for myself in a way that I want to do it. I think my experience of working for other people and doing it the way that they wanted it to be done and not necessarily agreeing with their methods,
mm-hmm.
didn't necessarily make for you know, a great kind of working relationship. So being able to kind of pull away from that and do it the way that I want to do it in a way that I think still works. Yeah, it's been really refreshing these last sort of, wow, what is it? We in April now, 6-7 months. I mean, that's flown by even in itself,
yeah.
Probably nearer to 8 months actually. So yeah, it's been a ride. It's been a you know, incredible kind of period of time for me.
Yeah. And was there a particular draw of why you wanted to come back into recruitment? Like, you know, you talked about you left and you kind of went back to a quote unquote normal job.
Yeah.
But then came back into game recruitment. So was that a thing where you were missing it to an extent, or you just missed the idea of being involved in the recruitment process or games in general?
Yeah. So, well, it was a mixture of both, to be honest. I think, you know, I'm an avid gamer, have been since I was 4 or 5 years old when I first picked up a controller for a SNES. And played Super Mario, you know, sort of 91, 92, I think, around about then.
Mine was Legend of Zelda on NES, so.
Yeah, yeah. So I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. And I've been a gamer ever since, really. I've been fortunate enough to own pretty much every console between then and now.
Definitely a fan. Yeah, because we had this conversation like before we started recording about how I've interviewed Lorne Lanning, who made Abe's Odyssey, and you were saying...
Yes.
Again, that speaks to your heart. Yeah. So,
yeah.
It's the old school gamer kind of idea of getting into games is difficult, because I think when I first got into the industry, I met a lot of people who worked in games and studios, but they weren't really gamers per se. They weren't really like me, like who obsessed over every console, every game, you know. And I worked for a couple of years as a journalist before I got into art. So I worked as a games writer, basically. But like that was on the side and that wasn't like an official job. But yeah, like, you find that it's like a thing that's either like a one or zero in the industry, where people either are huge fans of the industry or are just people trying to get a job.
Yeah. I've come across like both types of people, and I think like that extends to multiple different industries as well, really. I think you know, I've grown up with people that were quite athletic and quite sporty, and they played football and they played rugby because they were good at it, but actually in, you know, normal walk of life, like you ask them like, oh, who do you support, or did you watch the match at the weekend, and they're just like, nah, I can't really be bothered with it. And so I don't even really like it. I just do it because I'm good at it. And it's,
yeah,
you know, it you see that quite a lot in the games industry, right? You see a lot of programmers and engineers that are amazing with numbers and amazing at that kind of job, but ask them about kind of like their favorite game, or you know, what game are they playing at the moment, and
right. They're
probably like a little bit nonplussed.
Yeah.
But equally on the other end, like there are so many passionate gamers in the industry that you know, are working tirelessly on a game, and then they'll go home and then they'll put in 4 or 5 hours into, you know,
their personal stuff.
Yeah, doing kind of like Fortnite and Roblox and Starfield and things like that, you know.
Yeah, or making fan art based on the games that they love, like Zelda.
There's loads of different things going on.
Yeah, it's usually where I find people is people who are maybe working a really 9-to-5 job and they're working in the games industry, you know, sector, but then the thing that explodes online and ArtStation stuff like that is like they have a huge piece that comes out that's a fan piece of something. And like years ago, like Rodriguez, one of the friends that I have now, he done a Soul Reaver sculpt of Raziel, like, and it was done, you know, through ZBrush, and it was on ArtStation. It was incredible. And yeah, so we kind of started the conversation, but then he worked just a 9-to-5 at Riot Games. So it's one of these things where, you know, people have this passion of like, I love the game I work on, but also I love the other things I work on at night. So, but then it's difficult because I think to be at like, well, Riot Games, right? But to be at that level, you kind of need to be doing your job, but also doing all that stuff at night to keep improving constantly to get, you know, better and better jobs. And maybe one of the pitfalls of the industry, I feel, is like people sometimes take advantage of that passion. Like they will offer less money, or they will offer not great rates or conditions because they're like, oh, he's passionate. You know, he wants to work here because he loves the project. That's the big draw for him. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for our sins and for all the kind of rhetoric online of like, you know, recruiters are this, that, and the other. And, you know, I think that's kind of where we play our part quite a bit, is to make sure that people like that do get a fair deal.
Yeah.
You know, we are working on behalf of the studio, but equally we are working on behalf of the candidates as well, and making sure that, you know, their work is valued and their time and effort is valued. And I've had so many conversations with candidates that have applied for roles and they've massively undersold themselves because they're just so keen and eager to actually get their foot in
the door. Yeah.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But equally, like, I like having those conversations with those types of people because it's very clear that they're talented, very clear that they would do well in the interview process and mm-hmm. would do well in that role. And then they say, oh, I'm looking for 23K, 24K. And I'm like, no, wait, stop.
Yeah.
Like, the market rate for you right now is like 33, 34. And that's exactly what you should be aiming
like
for.
Like the low 20s is something like, it's almost minimum wage at this point. You know what I mean? So.
Right, exactly. And I think sometimes as well, like, because I've made that mistake myself, like, you know, job hunting previously when I was younger. I've gone into workplaces. I've gone in even into agency like recruitment roles that were you know, paying 20 as a mm-hmm. salary, but then you get X amount of bonuses on the top. And then you just realize actually that your base salary in that position is not even going to cover your basic living costs.
Yeah.
But you accept it anyway because you think, oh, this is a really good opportunity and I'm going to make mm-hmm. extra money in my bonuses and referrals and everything else of that. And by and large I have, but the point of it is that I believe that a salary should be the one thing that covers your basic living costs at any stage of your career. And then anything on top of that, like rev share, equity, anything else like that, is exactly what it is. It's a bonus. It's something on top.
Yep. I mean, that's one of the things I wanted to talk on. There's a couple of key points I wanted to hit along as talking. I'm only about 10 minutes in, so we've got time. But the first thing I wanted to talk about is the thing that I've experienced. So I'm from Scotland, obviously, as we talked about earlier with Iron Brew in my hand. But the UK in general, you know, and I'm also, people maybe know this from my socials, but I'm very political. So I have a very strong view on the current politics in the UK and you know, how London is running the country, which I don't think is well. But the UK in general, as we've seen in some of the Panoramic reviews and documentaries, that the UK is really just dragging this corpse along the bottom of the well, where, you know, the wages have stagnated for like something nearly 14 years. You know, we're talking, like we said, you know, people looking to 23, 24,000 as a wage, versus like people I know in the US, because obviously I have a lot of friends in big industry places in the US and California, and you know, the average over there for a starting salary is somewhere between $55,000 and $70,000. So it's like, even converted to UK pounds, that's something like 35 to 40. But how do you feel the industry, even stacked up against Europe, because I know Europe also is above us in terms of wages, do you feel the UK is lacking? Do you feel that's been a problem for a long time?
Yeah, I think so. First off, to like kind of tick off, you know, particularly about US salaries, right? Mm-hmm. So, because coming into going in, like recruiting into the US market for the first time two and a half, 3 years ago, seeing like kind of like those base salaries and knowing that I was going to get a percentage kind of commission based on the salary that people were getting.
That's like, how you make your money. It's how you make your living.
Yeah, exactly. Like the US market became very appealing in that sense, but it's worth noting that the cost of living in the US is markedly higher than probably what it is here, even in the UK.
Yeah.
So anyone that's been to the US on holiday, anybody that's been to GDC recently will know that like just what, just even things like fast food and stuff, it's, you know, it's, I would say there is a little bit of an equivalency thing going on there. You know, it's like minimum wage over there is probably something like the equivalent here is like 35K, but actually you go into a McDonald's over there and it's like $20 for a value meal. Do you know what I mean? Like, so there is a bit of an equivalency thing going on. To come back around to your question about like, you know, salaries stagnating here in the UK and things like that, I think it's really obvious. I think like, you know, across multiple industries, that has been the case for quite some time. And for various different reasons, that being said, like there's still nothing stopping candidates from asking for more, asking for what they feel like that they deserve, asking for what they feel like, you know, ticks off their basic needs. And then it's down to the individual companies to say yes or no, whether or not they can afford it.
Yeah.
I think like there was a great piece that I read recently where I think it was like through like 1970 and 1980, the average cost of a mortgage was equivalent to like 2 times your annual salary.
Yeah.
And I think it's something like 10 times now.
I think it's close. Yeah. I think I watched Steve Wright talk about that on BBC. It was something like close to 12 and a half times. It's something ridiculous. It's something that's obviously completely unattainable, but by modern standards. But yes, yeah, it's also dependent obviously where you live and,
of course,
you know, if you're in London versus like our London or city London, or if you're in the north of England, you know, all that
And I feel like those trends are happening even actually outside of London. So I live on the south coast in Portsmouth. So, you know, just seeing kind of how that is also kind of being replicated even outside the capital city is quite alarming. I think, you know,
No one can live in London at this point. It's way too expensive to like live in. It's just most houses are close to $1 million in the city centre. You know, it's
I see quite often like adverts for your private renting, and it's like £4,000 a month for a 1-bedroom flat, and it's
people, you know, selling off their back shed in the garden for like $600 a month or something.
It's crazy. I just can't even fathom like the type of salary that you would need just to you know, make that kind
a
of
banker salary.
That's what you would need.
Because I mean, I came across that a friend of mine's years ago who worked in, I don't name the studio obviously and drop names, but it was a AAA studio in London, and he was a singer there. I think he was a senior concept or senior character artist, and he was on $45K a year as a singer, which I think for London especially is a bit disgusting. It's a bit crazy because, you know, to live in London, you and I both know that it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money to live in that city. And 45K, while it seems like is a high salary for what we do, to the modern worker in any other industry, especially because I used to work in the rail industry and network rail, stuff like that. So there's guys I know down there who aren't even singers who make that kind of money, you know, lifting and shifting on a track. So it's like, you know, that's the thing that is annoying me, is that I don't think people are getting their worth when it comes to the work, you know what I mean? Considering how much they do. Considering how much you have to do beforehand just to get the job, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. No, for sure. And I'm really kind of like an advocate for making sure that studios are set up in a way that doesn't require candidates to do so much work before a decision is made. And equally, like, I've got so much like data like gathered up that I can show both studios and candidates to say, look, this is the going market rate, this is what you like the salary banding should be, and this is what you should be asking for as a candidate. And just trying to, you know, I a lot of my content on LinkedIn is always been about kind of making the hiring process as smooth and as easy as possible for both studios and candidates, and making sure that both people are getting as much value out of the system as possible. I think, you know,
it's difficult as well in the fact that, like, you know, I know some recruiters have talked to me about this, the fact that not every studio, obviously, this isn't a blanket statement, but the fact that some recruiters will have a budget for a hire, and yes, they will get an incentive or a kind of pat on the back or a bonus if they come in well under what they're supposed to be offering. You know, say they have 45 or 50 for the role, and the guy comes in and says, I'm looking for 40. And they're like, fantastic. Like, I've just saved the company 10 grand a year. So it's a thing as well where that incentive is in some studios where they'll try to, you know, almost lowball the candidates to try and get them in at a cheaper rate. Because again, I understand studios need to make money. It's a business at the end of the day. They want to save money. But it feels difficult how you'll have maybe 3 or 4 people on a senior team and every single one of them is at a different wage. You know what I mean? And that's also disparaging because you'll feel less than if you're coming in and saying, you know, you're maybe having an issue with your taxes and you're talking about your wage, and then your partner or colleague says, oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I only pay this much tax. Or like, oh, I've usually got this much left at the end of the month. And you start to do the math and you're like, are you earning more money than me? And you're in the same position, the same, you know, so that's, but that's tech in general. That's maybe no, like, exclusive to the games industry. Like, that's almost been the issue with tech or jobs in general over the last 10 years is talking about your wage openly. That seems to be a very big taboo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is something that I've never really been worried about. Like, me as an individual, I've worked in places and I've been very open about like what my salary is, what my commission is, what I'm earning and what I'm not.
Yeah. Which you should be, I think. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've got no issues with being kind of open with it. And if I find out that the person sat next to me doing exactly the same job is earning £5,000 or £6,000 more, then is that going to hurt me a little bit? Yeah, of course it does, because I feel like I'm offering exactly the same value, if not more. Sometimes, you know, you sit next to people and you go, I'm kind of doing a bit more work than you. And I feel like, you know, if you're earning more than me, then we need to have a conversation around why that's happening.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the reason why I advocate for people being open with their salaries and being open with what they're offering candidates. And there's a lot of studios that do that really, really well. You know, they're very open with that kind of, you know, who's on what and who's doing what and things like that. And for the most part, they will do their level headed best to make sure that everyone is on a, you know, even keel.
Yeah.
In terms of like, there's a seniority and it comes with a certain banding. So even if you are sat next to someone that is earning maybe £2,000 or £3,000 more, or less, like it's still within like a quite a strict banding and
there's 3 or 4% or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's a reason for why there is that disparity.
Maybe someone's had to move or come from another studio or give up another job or
Right. Exactly. So, you know, is there ever going to be a world where people
all hold hands and have the same wage?
Right. Exactly. Is everyone going to be like doing the same job, being paid to the penny, the exact same amount?
Yeah.
I think it's completely unrealistic to expect that. But that being said, I think like parity in salaries, particularly like within studios, is something really, really important and will definitely almost kind of like get ahead of the argument of, you know, I'm a senior, they're a senior, why are we not being paid the same or roughly the same amount of money? Because I've seen huge parities. I've seen as much as £15,000 difference for people that are doing exactly the same job. And it's really hard to understand why that's been allowed to happen.
Yeah, I think that's the difficulty as well, is the fact that like if people, like you said, if it's 3 or 4% difference, then nobody's really going to bother about stuff like that. But then like you said, if it's £15,000 in per month, you know, when you break it down, you're like, there's nearly, you know, an extra 150 in my bank every month. That's a difference. So you're thinking yourself, oh, I would pay my council tax. Like, you know, there's something, you know, you want to try and aim for like people being roughly within the margins of error on the same wage. But yeah, I think London especially, like I did, that's why I kind of almost had a visible gasp when he told me his wage. And I was thinking, for London, that seems like, you know, you'd think it would be way more than that. Especially given like some of the studios, you know, where, you know, they make decent money. You know, I mean, the ones that are still around, I mean, obviously have suffered recently because they've either cancelled projects or they've been hit with the recession or the layoffs. I mean, obviously, as we talk about the layoffs recently, Sony London Studios are gone, you know, are no more. So, and I think they had about 150, 200 people in them. So it's actually getting to the point now where there's so many people laid off in the UK, there just isn't enough jobs to absorb everybody. So it's now a thing where people are just kind of floating in limbo looking for work.
Yeah, I think this is a conversation that I've been having quite a lot more recently with people, particularly new people that are coming into the industry, you know, graduates and juniors that are, you know, just qualifying, and they're just kind of immediately thrown into this pool of people that are infinitely more experienced than they are. They've got the commercial success and the background, and they're basically essentially competing for the same jobs. The thing that I would say is that being a recruiter, I do see both sides of the coin. Mm-hmm. I see the layoffs. I see the people that, you know, that are affected by those. I see the studio closures. I see like all that kind of like heartbreak that comes with that. But equally, I'm also constantly talking to people, you know, in studios are saying, we're growing, we're hiring, we've got mm-hmm. jobs available. And I think the last count, you know, if you take a look at Amir Satvat's resources and the workbook that he's put together of all the available roles, I think there's about 13,000 live roles across the games industry right now. And a vast majority of that obviously will be in art and engineering and things like that, along with like ops and stuff. You know, in terms of equivalency, I think we talk about there being circa sort of 24,000-25,000 layoffs over the last 2 years. Oh, I mean, I don't know kind of how many of those people have, are now back in work,
mm-hmm.
plus the additional 13,000 live roles that are still available. But you are right. Like there is a noticeable shortfall in the number of people that have lost their jobs over the last 2 years versus mm-hmm. the number of available roles. But what I will say is, you know, coming back to, you know, earlier on in our conversation, you know, when I first started my recruitment career
mm-hmm.
In 2011, you know, that was off the back of mass layoffs in tech and gaming industry specifically. And the gaming industry was so much smaller back then than what it is now. And I think if we look back, the numbers of layoffs were fairly similar. I think it was about 19,000-20,000 across a 2-year period. So as a percentage basis, it was, you know, markedly bigger impact on the industry mm-hmm. then. But what we saw come out of that, you know, across 2010, 2011, 2012, so many new studios opened up, so much more experience was in the market. And these experienced heads got together and was like, look, we can do this better. We can do it. You know, we can make our own thing.
Yeah.
And they did exactly that. And those studios 13 years later are now the AAAs that are, you know, still hiring, still growing. They're still doing things in a very much, you know, sustainable way. And, you know, my hope is that of that group of people that have been laid off over the last 2 years, that we see a very similar thing happen, is that a lot more of these kind of like smaller indie studios do like spring from this, and that in 2-3-4 years time, we can start having a conversation about those people, you know, growing and building their studios, and they're, you know, they're hiring 50, 60, 100 people over that period of time. It's going to be a great thing to witness and watch.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. I think I found where game studios, it's difficult when they grow at that rate, because I don't think game studios should be any more than 100 people. I think anything more than that, you're starting to struggle with communication across the studio is one of them, obviously, you know, trying to keep everybody on the same page, but also, you know, disparities in wage, HR, you know, conditions for living, and also just a communication breakdown and making the game look like one cohesive project and keeping everybody in line. And it's obviously why you have managers, and managers have people, and people have managers, and I get that. But like, I think one of the booms we had with stuff like Riot Games and Blizzard is that they were kind of just expanding constantly. There was never a period where there was a layoff of just the fact that like, we're not hiring this year, or we aren't taking anyone for 6 months. There was just, every time you went on the website, it was just constant, more and more people. And then of course, when the inflation or the investment balloon burst, then it was the fact of, now we have too many people, we'll go. It's difficult, I think, Blizzard, we can talk about that to an extent, where the thing I found was really scummy, specifically with what Phil Spencer done with the studio, was, you know, after the acquisition had went through and everything was finalized, he was at a huge party for Blizzard where everybody came out to the campus, and like all my initial friends in the industry were all from Blizzard. So I was seeing everybody's feed at the time, people taking pictures, and they were out, you know, meeting Phil and having cake with him and beer, and they paid for, I don't even know how much the party would have cost Blizzard, or would Microsoft might have paid for it, where, you know, there was a big fanfare and there was things going on and everybody, if they should, and huge thing all happened. Everybody's happy, cheering, a big thing where they all cheered and went, yeah, we're part of the Xbox family, took pictures. And then within 3 weeks, everyone was laid off. You know what I mean? It's like, why breed that culture of we're glad to be part of the Xbox family, however?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
it was a funny thing watching it, because obviously here in the UK, there was a court case. There was we're trying to block the acquisition because it was monopolizing and everything else like that. So, which obviously eventually failed for various reasons of competition laws, yeah, and things like that. They circumnavigated it and mm-hmm. got around it and stuff like that. And that's okay, fine, if that's the letter of the law and that's the way that it is.
Yeah,
but I think I even prior to that going through, I was saying to anybody that would listen, there will be layoffs. There will be significant layoffs.
Oh yeah.
Because when you have a business like Microsoft overlapping with a business like Activision Blizzard King, yeah, like there is inevitably going to be duplication of roles. And that's mm-hmm. essentially what the layoffs kind of were about.
Yeah.
In this specific instance. And as far as my knowledge goes of people that have worked at ABK mm-hmm. and a lot of the media that has covered the layoffs as well, it was about duplication of roles.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily where we've seen more recently with like Crop Circle, for example, where it's potentially poor financial mismanagement or poor management decisions.
That could be a whole podcast, just that.
Yeah, I know. I've been following it and I'm waiting for the article to come out and
drop. Yeah, we all are. Yeah.
Yeah. But I feel like, that kind of overlap with two massive businesses like that, there was always going to be an issue with duplication of roles, and
yep.
you don't need too many people doing the same job, right? So it's a huge shame. And like, there were, I think the significant number of layoffs is probably the headline factor in that. I think it was 1,500 in the end. So mm-hmm. not a small amount of people by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, it was nearly 2,000, wasn't it? It was 1,900, wasn't it?
Yeah, was it as much as that? So I saw 1,500 in the immediate.
Still a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. It's
1,900 people that can't pay their mortgage or can't pay their bills next month of their health insurance. Yeah, it's like, yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, that's also the depressing thing, not to cut you in here, but like just the thing of seeing like people on LinkedIn being like, I can't pay for my heart medication next month, I might die.
Yeah.
It's just like, what the fuck? Like, you know, it's just...
You can't even comprehend, can you?
Yeah.
The lack of like... empathy in that decision making, and I totally get it in a sense of like so much advice comes from like people that maybe are in a position of privilege, or certainly advice that I've received previously, because I've been made redundant myself in other roles. That it's a business decision; it's not personal; it's not anything to do with you as a person or your performance or anything.
Even if the studio runs out of money, it's just like, what else can you do? There's no money left.
Exactly, that's fine. I totally appreciate that. But like you said, when you're then watching, stories like you've just mentioned there play out, and it's like, the impact on that as an individual. Okay, fine. The decision to make you redundant wasn't personal, but now it is affecting you personally.
Yeah,
is it's just crazy, and it's heartbreaking to see some those cases play out the way they are.
One of these things where it's why I run the Discord and why I've really been trying to champion the job board and like helping people back in, and even why we set up like a small indie dev like developer within the Discord to make a game, just to give them something to do while they're looking for something else, and if the game takes off, great, that's something else they can put in their CV, but whatever. But yeah, it's difficult because like, even as an individual, I can only do so much. Like I can only catch so many people as they fall. You know, when the Discord started, I think we had 200 people back in like December, now we have nearly 1500. So it's like, it's great we have those people on board and they have somewhere to kind of converse. But like, mm-hmm. at the same time, I just want to get as many people back into work as I can. And it's difficult because like, the way the whole industry is sitting right now, it is difficult to get them back in, although like you say, maybe 10% are back in work or maybe more. But yeah, it's the landscape at the moment is difficult, to say the least.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm still very hopeful of that tide turning, and even more recently, like I'm seeing a lot more people on my LinkedIn feed of like, oh, I've got a new job, I've got a new role. I'm seeing that now a lot more often than I am seeing news about studio closures. So even that is, a turning of the tide a little bit. I think what you've built with the Discord server is incredible. I think the fact that you've got a job board channel on there as well, and you know, signposting people towards those particular roles is fantastic as well. So you know, I think people like yourself and people like Amir and Alexander Rem and Aaron Goldsmith and everyone else that's you know, part of that community of people that pushing and driving people and signposting people towards you know, different
socializing things. Because Aaron's even started the whole like social Saturday or social Sunday, but the thing of like just drop in and say who you are, drop your link, you know, meet people.
And the thing is as well, you never know where that might lead or where that conversation might go. I think, you know, the number of times that I've spoken to someone just on the off chance of like, you know, I might be able to help them, and then it turns out that actually they're able to help me and assist me, you know, either it be for a referral or a introduction or a recommendation or whatever. Like, and I think that's probably one of the key points that I would really want to someone to take away from this podcast, is that networking and connection with individuals is so, so important. And we mentioned obviously it right at the beginning of this podcast, so like being able to do face to face and being able to do these like video calls and things like that is really, really important. Because you don't know where that's going to lead.
The contact will bring in the future.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, and I just recently actually did a talk with a group of students at Atlas School over in Tulsa, in the US. And that was something as well that I was just trying to get across to them as well. Just like, get out, meet people, go to events, build an online presence, contact people, talk to people, ask like genuine questions and things that you want to know. And, you know, always kind of pushing the idea of like, don't be disingenuous with it in any way. You know, there's no value in contacting an art director and going, here's my artwork, I'd really like to come work with you, but like, you know, because that's they get thousands of those probably in a week, and you know, it's just unsustainable for them to come back and respond to every single one. But if you are a concept artist that has a specialism in sci-fi and you like creating fantastical alien-like creatures, and you know of a studio that is creating a game that fits that, absolutely reach out to the art director, reach out to the art manager and go, look, I've just read that you're creating this amazing title. It really fits like the type of work that I love creating. Can you take a look at my portfolio and tell me what you think? You might get good feedback on your portfolio. You might get constructive criticism. You might get nothing at all. But the point is that you've taken the time out to understand what it is that they're doing, what they're working on. It aligns with what you want to do with your career and what you're passionate about. And I guarantee you that 70%, if not 80% of the time, you will get some sort of conversation formed off of the back of that. I would never advocate for anyone just going out and applying to 100, 200 different roles with the same CV, with the same portfolio, going to a range of different studios that do totally different titles that just don't match what your previous experience is, or the art style that you do. Like, really like drill down and focus on what it is that you want to do, what you're good at, and which studios and which people are going to pay attention to that the most. That's what I would say.
Yeah, it feeds into a bit of advice I got way back in the day locally here in Scotland, because I got to like early on in my career when I left my job and I started going back to school and looking to any concept and other things. I had a conversation with an art director at Rockstar North, where obviously they make Grand Theft Auto up here. But he always talked about the funny thing of they get so many portfolios with like stylized orcs and Warcraft art and stuff like that, but then their games are mostly realistic and take place in cities. He's like, so, you know, where is that going to fit into the thing we're doing currently? If it's Grand Theft Auto 5 at the time, or it was 6 now, you know, how does that apply to what we're trying to make? And if it isn't, you know, if there's zero relatability, then yeah, of course, why would he even respond? So like, you know, I always kind of laughed at the time and said, I could never imagine when people would do that. But, you know, I've seen it more and more now for the industry, where people will send me stuff and say, I want to work for Blizzard, I want to work for Riot Games, fantastic. It's a great aspiration to have. And then you look at their stuff and it's like, well, it's super realistic. There's a lot of PBR materials. There's a lot of realistic lighting. You know, I can't really see a lot of stylization in your art. Your rendering skills aren't quite high enough. But then, you know, if I apply and I get a junior job, I'm like, yeah, but then you should be hitting like at least a couple of landmarks before you even apply to studios like that. Like some kind of thing where an art director can look at your portfolio in 3 seconds and think, okay, cool. I can see him working on Legends of Runeterra or League of Legends or whatever, or Valorant. You know, like it just makes sense to look at their portfolio and think, oh yeah, that makes sense to me. Because even like some of my friends who have went from, you know, working on Agents of Mayhem or Saints Row, and then, you know, Volition, and then they went to work at Valorant, you know, and then from there worked in Counter-Strike 2 and are now at Warcraft. So like you can see a progression where their portfolio has led them through, because it's the same kind of level of stylization throughout all the projects, and it makes more sense to then jump from those games because they all kind of fit within one bracket. So
yeah, and that's a great point as well, is that, you know, progression is something that can and does happen a lot in the industry as well. Like just because your portfolio is very like photorealistic Unreal Engine 5, you know, it looks stunning, like if that's not the type of work that you want to be doing long term, and you do want to be doing more stylized stuff, that's great. But understand that your portfolio, the way that it's set up now, is not going to immediately lead to those types of opportunities and roles, because the hiring managers will want to see stylized, fantastical kind of creature, you know, work before, you know, that conversation happens. So there's nothing wrong with then like going into a studio, like you said, like a Rockstar North, that very much focus on, you know, urban landscapes, realism. I know they use proprietary tech, so Unreal Engine isn't necessarily relevant to that conversation, but you know,
if you can work in something like Unreal and know the basics, you will be able to translate that to
Rage
Engine.
Yeah. So you know, it's one of those things. But then, like, you know, as you mentioned, like there's then nothing stopping you from like then transitioning into more stylized, more fantastical things later on in your career once you've built that portfolio around that, whether that be with personal projects, whether that be given the opportunity within the studio that you're currently at to work on those types of things. You know, it all comes with time and development of that. But there's one thing that certainly was always like drummed into me quite early on in a very kind of corporate world of recruitment, was always the saying of dress for the job that you want. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily relevant to like today's society, because I think a lot of people now, like, there's very much dressed down and this kind of like suit and tie, you know, in the office kind of idea is slowly evaporated. But the principle of it is still very much the same, right? If you want to be a stylized character artist working on something like League of Legends, working on something like Warhammer, you know, then create your portfolio around that. Make sure that your portfolio looks like you can do those types of characters and that type of art on a consistent, regular basis and to a high level. And those will be the jobs that you end up getting. Those will be the jobs that you'll get a lot of, you know, feedback from, even if it is constructive criticism and ways for you to improve for the next time you apply. That's just all I would say, is that, you know, it is very much the principle of dress for the job that you want, and not the one that you have.
Yeah, I mean, one of the best pieces of advice I had also was from a guy at Pixar. He was doing a talk at IMAG in Paris, and he was talking about you should be working like you already have the job.
Yes.
Like if you have nothing to do, say you're fresh out of school and you're basically, you've graduated, you're sitting there, you know, Monday to Friday, and you've no real work to do, you know, outside of your normal job. Get up at 9 o'clock in the morning, sit down with a task, do it all day, finish at 5, clock off, relax, rinse and repeat the whole week until you have a portfolio of work, because that will be more determined in getting you work than, you know, maybe spending 2 or 3 hours a month on one piece and then saying, okay, there's one thing, I'll spend next month on another thing. You know, the idea I've always been told by a lot of senior guys is consistency. That's what people want to see more than like good work. Like the work has to be of a standard, but like if they can at least see you're trying, like, oh, like you put out like 2 or 3 projects in a week, or like, you know, he's put out 2 or 3 projects in a month, but every month, you know, like if that's the idea that you have behind your portfolio, is that at least it's not like industry standard or like, you know, senior level or whatever you're hoping for. But if you're consistently putting out decent work every other week, then sure, that gets you more attention than like not doing anything at all. And I mean, I'm very guilty of it myself, but more on my journey about like how I just can't decide what I want to do. But like, even the thing when I wanted to work for Hearthstone, and I mean, that's still a dream of mine, but like, I'd done this challenge when I was like, I'm going to study a Hearthstone card every day for a month. So every single day I'll put a card next to me, I'll open Photoshop and I'll copy it to my best of my ability. And I'll give myself 3 hours every time. And yeah, like I've done it consistently enough that like people from Blizzard were adding me and were commenting on it and being like, oh, this is incredible, man, really well done, and blah, blah, blah. You know, and obviously, you know, I'm copying work, so it's not my own, and I'm just, you know, studying whatever other people are doing. But the relationships are then formed to then go into the studio in 2019 and do a tour in LA. Like, people were always like, you know, I was getting introduced as Gordon, and people were like, oh yeah, and then I showed them my socials and like, oh yeah, I remember, like, you done the Hearthstone thing years ago. Like, it breaks into people's minds that you at least have tried. And it's the same way like recruiting art directors into your cause. You know, when I first met Raf Grizzetti, like, he always talked about the thing of like, if you get people's attention, like his attention specifically, and then you get it, and it's like, right, okay, Raf's following me on Instagram, or he's following me on LinkedIn, or whatever he's doing. If you then make work that is good enough, Raf would probably reach out to you versus you reaching out to him. Like, you can reach out to art directors and say that you want work, but if you just start with a simple hi, how you doing, and form like almost like a friendship, and then if you're constantly posting stuff on LinkedIn that is really, really good, Raf might occasionally, or whoever, our director would occasionally reach out to you and say, hey man, just to let you know, like, you know, I've noticed that you put out like a bunch of really good work recently, and I've really enjoyed what I've been seeing. Are you interested in a job? I've got one coming up. Like, that organic stuff is more akin to getting you work than anything else in the industry. Darren doing a nod in here, I'm assuming he agrees with what I'm saying.
Yeah. This is something that I've been trying to get across to as many people as will listen. You know, it's mm-hmm. it is about that kind of putting yourself out there, creating that content, you know, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, just going back over, like, create that network, create those connections. Like, people need to understand, like, particularly in this moment in time where the industry is in such a flux, and the market is absolutely flooded with candidates right now, mm-hmm. is that, you know, someone is posting a job on a job board, and particularly depending on the level, you know, I mean, even now, even at kind of, I would say, even at mid senior roles, mm-hmm. like, they are instantly getting 50, 60, 100 plus applications, right? And that is a lot of time and a lot of effort on the recruiter or the HR or the hiring manager's part to sift through every single one of those and make sure that A, they're immediately relevant for the role, B, are they worth, you know, screening and interviewing and going through the process with. But if they already kind of know of you and know of your work, yes. you've already got, you know, that foot in the door. That question of, are they relevant for this role, and are they, you know, are they capable of doing this job on a consistent and to a high quality basis, that question has already been answered in that person's yeah. mind when they're reviewing your CV and your portfolio. So, you know, if you talk about like wanting to stick out amongst 100 different applicants, it would be that, is put content out where people can see it, create conversations, build a network that is relevant to the role that you want to do. So, you know, if you're a concept artist, add as many concept artists, lead concept, lead, you know, 3D, lead 2D, art directors, art managers, mm-hmm. you know, add as many people as you can that you know, have relevant job titles with seniority as well. People that are going to be able to make a decision on you and be able to appropriately judge the work that you do, and give feedback and give constructive criticism on how to improve. You know, likewise, if you're an engineer or a programmer, and I know that's not necessarily relevant to a vast majority of your audience, but the same mm-hmm. same goes. You know, if you're currently looking for work, but also not consistently contributing to things like GitHub community projects and stuff like that, and consistently putting out like stuff that you've worked on or building stuff for yourself, even as like a you know, a demonstration of your skills, then hiring managers aren't going to know what you're capable of beyond mm. what you've put down on a bit of paper, you know?
Yeah, it's very relevant, I think. And, you know, we've been talking about recruitment for a while, and it's one of these things where, like, yeah, it's a hellish landscape, but I think, like you said, there is hope in the fact that, like, the industry will go through a shift And, you know, out the other side of that, like you said, new studios will pop up, but also new roles might appear. There might be things that, you know, we never thought would be a job and then eventually will be a job, because obviously, like, you know, I always talk about when I started in the industry and left my job back in 2012, concept design was fairly new. It was becoming its own specialized category of work and job. So it's like, you know, where the landscape's going to go in the next 5 years is very difficult to predict. But I think as long as you are adaptable to what you do and can learn pretty quickly and have an eye for detail, you'll always find work in some sector or other. You always have some variation of work that you can do. So, which is, I think, probably relevant to what we're going to kind of close on. But so AI is obviously something we've talked about a bit. And, you know, the industry as a whole is kind of, you know, adjusting as it takes its claws into many various fields of the tech industry and sector. You know, you always see these articles about the guy that laid off 95% of his staff to be replaced by AI and stuff like that. And we kind of talked about its origins and where it's went and why we think it's maybe hollow. And then on the inside, you know, I think AI, for me at the moment, I think it is over-promising and under-delivering on what it can do. People are kind of touting it as the next generation. But it's funny because I've read two books so far from people who have studied AI most of their lives, and they're kind of like saying that they don't see it attaining this like oneness, the singularity, for at least like another 30 years. You know, they feel like it's way off in the distance. They don't think it's anywhere near capable. You know, it can talk in a sense that it can respond and answer questions, but intelligence of that level, like human intelligence, they feel is like still like way off in the distance, like nowhere close to where it is now. How do you see it affecting the job market in the future and like where it is currently?
Yeah, it's an interesting question and certainly pertinent to artists, I would say, because there's obviously a lot of
Gen AI stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of like generative AI and Midjourney and Runway, and like there just seems to be like a new program like every week that is constantly improving and constantly able to effectively do what concept artists and 2D and 3D artists have been doing for, you know, forever and a day as their profession. What I would say is right now I can see where it would fit into the art pipeline in terms of being able to give inspiration, being able to give like real artists, you know, something to draw from
and like blue sky kind of stuff.
Right, exactly. You know, I want to create, you know, alien world that has, you know, these colors and this kind of, you know, foliage and vegetation and things like that, and then pop, you know, something comes up and you go, oh, I can take something from that and I can take something from this, and, you know, brilliant. In terms of like, do I ever see or foresee, you know, Midjourney and Runway and things like that, like, you know, the output actually being implemented into the art pipeline and eventually into a finished game? Short answer, no. And the reasons for that is because there's so many little kind of flaws and optimizations. And I mean, even now, like there's a legal conversation about, you know, where is it actually getting the images from? Where is it actually getting the animations from?
Because that EU law has just, I don't know if people know this, but the European Union has just recently passed a law on AI that makes it so that companies now have to disclose where they get their information from.
Yeah, exactly. But just even like generative AI machines in itself, like I think it's been proven now beyond any doubt that, you know, you put in a prompt into Midjourney and it throws up a picture, and chances are it's a mishmash of copyrighted art that already exists. So, you know, there's that conversation to be had if a game studio is going to start using generative AI in its art.
This could be a legal nightmare. Yeah,
exactly. So I think, you know, for the most part, most game studios are avoiding it. There's a lot of advocacy to avoid it as well. There's lots of people that are now very much like quite vocal about being anti AI and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
The only thing that I would add to maybe balance that and be a bit more kind of positive about AI is just in the kind of normal everyday tasks that you would maybe spend minutes or hours on doing in the week that you no longer have to do. So things like, for me, I use it for inspiration on like creating content for LinkedIn, for example. Like,
right, yeah.
what can I talk about that will get this outcome, or this, you know, what can I suggest as a talking point based on this week's news, that sort of thing, rather than me scrolling through several different news sites and several different publications, you know, looking for kind of talking points to develop content and things like that. Like, you know, ChatGPT will just list a load of bullet points for me, and then I'll go, okay, yeah, that's cool. I can talk about that. I've got knowledge on that situation. I can do this. Brilliant. Okay, fine. Still not an advocate for, you know, copy and pasting straight off ChatGPT, because it's so obvious. It's so, I don't think people realize this as well. Like, people that are copy and pasting ChatGPT content are putting it on their LinkedIn feed, or putting it on their CV or their cover letter.
Yeah.
It's so obvious that that is what you've done. So please stop doing it. But using it as a tool of inspiration, I've got no issues with. And yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't see it forming any part of workflow or
pipelines
or anything like that anytime in the near future, if at all. I mean, you talk about that kind of like period of singularity being, you know, decades off, even
towards the end of the century anyway. Yeah.
But even at that point, I just don't see why that would be a thing when we've got human artists that can put human emotion and blood, sweat and tears into a product. And ultimately, like, that is what is going to sell the product as well, is the fact that it's been created by people like me and you that, you know, there's so much more value to that than just a nameless, faceless AI piece of art being part of a game that we're playing. Like, it just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Yeah. So as of this recording, Feng Zhu has done a really good video on AI and his thoughts on it after coming back from Paris. So I don't know if you know Feng. So Feng is one of the biggest concept artists in the world. He worked originally on the prequels, the Star Wars prequels, alongside Ian McKaig, but then formed his own studio in Shanghai, and it has now taught people at what's called the FCD School in Singapore. But he's taught there for the last 10 years. And when he came back from iMag, he saw the problem that really resonated with local concept artists was that people are making more or less the same thing, haven't been on ArtStation for long enough, which is, you know, the big, beautiful picture with the big building or the big thing in the background and the little people at the side. There's a kind of copy paste of that over and over and over again. And he's like, sure, Midjourney can copy that stuff, and that looks kind of cool. But what it really should be doing is, you know, can you take a room in the ship and explode it, you know, and fill it with a bed and a bedside cabinet and a computer and make it look lived in, you know, tiny details to all the little things that are on the desk, you know, like building out like a design process and problem solving like that. He's like, in my eyes, Midjourney could never do that at the moment as it sits. Like, it's just something it can't do. Like that, and that's the thing. He's like, as a concept designer, that's the thing you should be focusing on, is that kind of work, is that, you know, the big blue sky, fancy portrait landscape stuff where like the big building, the little person, like that's always great to look at as like, you know, like a bit of inspiration. But then if Midjourney can do that in a couple of seconds, fair enough. But then take one of those ideas and really dial in on the problem solving of what does the captain's quarters look like? What does the engine room look like? What does the main drive look like? You know, like all that kind of stuff, the mechanical hard surface, inner workings, like that's the thing that will get you work versus the blue sky stuff, which is pretty pictures, you know, unless you're working for like, you know, like you said, like Magic the Gathering or Hearthstone, and you want to do like the big splash images, fair enough. Like that's your thing. It's way different from concept design. But if design is a thing you need to get into, then design is what you should focus on. And I think you're right in what you're saying, is that people obviously think about AI being integral to the process and how it's going to, you know, interrupt the concept design and the 3D guys. But the people I've spoke to who are senior level and higher have said that they have been not worried, because they understand the pipeline so, you know, inherently, because I've worked on it for years and years and years, and they're like, this has no place in what we do, because we know, because we manage people from day to day. What I don't really agree on, and I'm glad Feng made the video, because what's been vacant from the landscape for the last 2 years is a senior person like Feng coming out and saying, I don't think it's going to work. I don't think you've nothing to worry about, like, but you should focus on this, but still at the same time, it's not going to take your job. I think just one person saying that would have been like so beneficial to everybody in the landscape, but everybody who was senior or higher was always just being like, ah, you know, I'm not worrying about it, so why should you?
Yeah,
I get it. But then you've got all these thousands of students who are coming to school looking at AI thinking, oh, shit, like, what the fuck am I going to do?
So, yeah,
it's difficult.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And like I said, just to conclude on that, I don't think it's going to interrupt the pipeline or anything. I don't think it's going to take away from jobs or keep people from getting into those kind of graduate junior positions or even like early stage art, like concept and 2D illustration and storyboarding and things like that.
Yeah.
Those will still very much need human eye, human hand.
Yep.
Yeah. For someone that actually appreciates the output and appreciates the final product,
yeah,
it is maybe actually like, it's going to sound odd to say, but actually it's probably less about the skill, but actually more about the emotion and the effort and the effort that goes into it.
Like, honest to God, this is the conversation I had with somebody the other day, and it blew my mind when I came up with this thought, but it was so obvious, right? We're like, so we talked about the origins of AI, and if you really dig into it, and see where these people have come from, you know, what other industry they've left to come in AI, which is, we've talked about crypto and NFTs. And even the fact that now is it Stable Diffusion? So their CEO just left because the guys have went bankrupt. So a lot of that's really just self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, it's all speaking for itself about what that has as an industry, what's propped up. But yeah, I was like, the thing with AI is there is no soul.
Yeah,
there's no soul to the world. Like, you can feel when you look at, like, one of my friends, one of my really good friends, Matt Gazer, when he's painting stuff for Star Wars or Disney, you see the inherent emotion that he's trying to convey in that piece, the warm and cool colors. And the big thing people talked about is the reason people are pulling away from AI is the storytelling. Like, people just aren't telling stories like they used to. And there's a really good YouTube artist I follow called Inkwell Dustin, and his stuff inherently is just like open a page in a storybook. Like, he does small, concise little illustrations, but it's like maybe like a kid leading a horse that's actually a parrot to like a market or something, and they're interacting with like a little adventure. Like, those little story, like warm moments that have a bit of soul to them. That's what is missing from AI, and what I think machines can never really replace is that human element of emotion in what you make. Because we are passionate, like artists especially. I mean, engineers, I'm not saying aren't passionate. Of course, programming is as much an art as anything else, the same as medicine, but like, art specifically, picture art, I think, you have to pour so much of yourself into what you do. And AI is definitely missing that. And I think until that problem is solved or that question is answered, then it will never really pose a threat to us as a community.
No, totally agree. Totally agree.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I'm glad I got that off my chest, basically. I've been waiting to talk about that for you. As soon as you say that, that's why I started clapping. I was like, oh my God, this guy's in the same wavelength as me, totally. But yeah, so like, I think that you say that the overall conversation we've had is long, but at the end of it, the short thing we've talked about is that it's a difficult time, but there is hope, there is light at the end of the tunnel. Just everybody who's here, hang on, and you know, things will turn around. As much as there are, you know, valleys in this industry, there are also peaks, you know, so like, it will ride out again. And like I think you've seen that as well, the Larian Studio CEO Sven, when he did his talk at GC, he was talking about, you know, the idea of like, stop just laying everybody off after 5 years and then struggling and crambling to get people back together again to make another studio. Like, just keep people hired and don't like get rid of the talent. So I'm hoping with also the unionization that's happening with Sega and other things like that, like, I'm hoping, because we've had labor unions in the UK for a long time, we know the benefit of them. So it's like, if we can just start to get like those machines and go. And when you think about it as well, games industry's only really been born in something like the 70s or 80s. You know, the film industry took, I think, the first 100 years just to get, you know, to where it is today. So like,
it's true.
We're at the birth of an industry, essentially, you know. So we were born or were kids at the time when the industry was becoming a thing. So it makes sense that it's going through what we call the growing pains of the industry, that's starting to figure all these things out, like unions and contracts and long-term stability, 401ks and pensions. So we'll get there. Games aren't going anywhere, I can assure you.
No,
keep making more and more money. They're going to be here for a while. So
absolutely.
Thank you to Darren for being here. If you guys have stayed to this point, it's been great talking to you. We might even try and get you back semi-regularly to talk about the industry as it kind of moves and
Yeah, I would, think I'd love that. Yeah, I'd love to you know come back and you know maybe talk again in 6 months' time, and hopefully we're talking about a number of different studios that have opened and are hiring people, and you know talking about more stable kind of future for the for the industry. I think you're picking up on what you just said there about like the unionization of Sega workers in America. I think you know I'm going to love seeing that play out over the next 6-9 months and see kind of where that goes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's one of these things. I might even be talking to the guys at Empty Vessel who've just formed a studio. I know they announced that not too long ago. So Mick Gordon is their head of audio there. So that's going to be whatever they're going to make. The audio is going to be epic to listen to. But yeah, they might be coming on, and they've started a studio out the back of like you know what's been happening in the industry. So that will be interesting if they come on. But yeah, we'll definitely get you on, and we'll try and keep updating with where the things are going. If people want to reach out to you or they want to get involved with what you're doing, obviously I'll leave links below, whatever you give me, but in general, where can they find you?
Yeah, so LinkedIn, Darren Butler, the gaming recruiter, and you can email me darren@gamingrecruiter.co.uk.
Cool. I'll leave that down below, and obviously in the description links you guys can check out Darren's work and what he's doing. And just again to thank you, Darren, for coming on, and you guys for listening. If you have any questions for Darren, leave them down below, or you can reach out of course to his contact details, and we'll see you guys in the next episode. Thanks again for listening and checking out what we've been doing here, and I hope you guys are all staying safe and creative wherever you are. Bye guys.